And so one thing I've noted yes. since the last time we did this, and I don't know how long ago, was it a year ago?
Yes, I think so. It's our annual
We do it once a year, right?
Yeah.
Once or twice. I haven't been back since then, right?
Not sure. No. Don't think so.
Is that you've changed the name?
Yes.
Of the podcast.
You noticed that?
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if I'd sneak that through.
No, I saw that. I saw that in the... in the graphic that you put up.
Right, yes.
Explain the thinking behind it. Or do we need to go through the history of what the name was prior to that?
We can do, why, I assumed we were going to talk about that. Okay. I have been questioning things about the name and everything and the intention of the show for a while. I'm sure you remember back in a couple of years ago talking about that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually Christmas Eve where I just had this moment where I thought, all right, I'm just going to do it. I'm just going to cut the name in half. So it was always called Don't Give Up Your Day Job.
Yep.
I'm going to cut off the last part and call it Don't Give Up.
Yep.
And just steer the show in a slightly different direction. And, I mean, it's basically a rebrand, I guess, and in some ways a sort of a restart a little bit. But my main reason for doing it is that, you know, I mean, you can explain where the name came from. In fact, do you want to do that first?
Yeah. Oh, so, yes.
Yeah.
Over many years of being what you would call a professional musician, and making what people assume was a decent living out of it, you know, that was your full-time job, and it was the full, that was the full income. Not that it was a great income, but it was something that you had to give your, I gave my life to and my full energies and time.
Mm-hmm.
And the irony of that is that that's the day job, and I couldn't give it up. That was something I wanted to do. I make music professionally, perform, record, and release music. And but there's an irony to that because a lot of people will tell you don't give up your day job if they think you're not good enough for something, right?
Yeah.
And so it was a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek play on that concept of, well, you know, I'm doing this professionally, kind of successful at it, but also feel like not so in some ways, you know. But then there's that twist on it, like that's the day job. If you're going to do it professionally, do it properly, do it as best you can with the skills and resources you have. Which might mean diversifying your
skill sets.
Yeah, like learning how to do video editing or learning how to do other things with the resources that you have. So, you know, as a musician, you sink a lot of money into gear and equipment. So how would you diversify your income stream, your revenue stream? Okay, well, maybe you could teach lessons.
Right.
Maybe you could learn how to use your equipment in other ways that will earn you money. So, yeah, it's kind of all tied up into that don't give up your day job, tongue-in-cheek thing. And in a way to encourage people to keep doing your passion. And then we can probably get into various reasons why that's not necessarily feasible for people as a long-term approach or strategy or whatever. By that I'm saying me. And we can talk about that later. And then, so I had that idea in my head that when I was meeting a lot of people out on the traps doing the music scene, that they just didn't have a clue, the general public, that is, I'm saying. Didn't seem to have a clue about the realities or what it means to be a creative, more specifically a musician, a professional musician who's doing it for a living, making music, recording, touring and stuff.
And we've got to blame pop culture and media and documentaries and books and all that stuff, right?
All of that
stuff.
Because
it's all puffed up with PR and fantastical thinking and legendary stuff, like legendary thinking and so on.
Yep, and long-gone eras of, things that are long, long gone.
Exactly.
But then, you know, you get the odd person who would make the assumption, oh, well, you're in a really successful band, you're selling lots of records, and so you must be really creaming it, making a lot of money. And I found that when you were being honest about it and saying, actually, no, I've got, once this tour's finished, I got to go find a job kind of thing, or I can't even pay the mortgage in the next couple of months. Because, you know, being a musician is kind of seasonal, unless you're touring outside of New Zealand, and, you know, you've got other opportunities to tour. And so the income, you know, you've got to make it sort of last you across the year. But people, when you tried to give them the facts about it, they kind of almost seemed a little bit offended, but also downtrodden. It's like, oh, yeah, that's right. New Zealand's such a small market.
Right.
You're not going to be able to, you know, to do it full time. So in a way, I wanted to try and put a more of a positive spin on it. And I thought maybe someone could make a documentary about it and just get the and it's not a, you know, meant to be pessimistic or apocalyptic, but be realistic about what it takes or what the reality is for people in the creative and specifically music scene to make a living from it.
Right.
So it became Don't Give Up Your Day Job. And then I think a few years after I had that thought about it, I met you.
Yeah.
And we were in an 80s review band.
And weren't you? Hadn't you tried to pitch this idea to a few people here and there?
Mm.
Yeah. And it hadn't resonated with anyone.
I had pitched the idea. I didn't know that there were, you know, television companies were open to you just pitching ideas to them.
I didn't know that until this minute.
they still are, you know, they are.
A phone call.
It's a process, and it helps to have people on the inside who can help you with that. Not that I did, but I've learned since then.
Right.
So I just directly approached TVNZ from their website info link on their website.
Amazing.
And went, you know, hey, I've got this idea. Here's who I am. Here's my background. Here's my pedigree, so to speak. And I was lucky enough to get it straight onto the... so you go through a process, you know, they do all this thing. But that went straight through the review process, that idea. Someone came back to me, some executive, I guess, young up-and-coming producer, went, hey, I've got this thing that's come to me.
Right.
Come across my desk, the person who was answering the emails that day.
Yeah.
And so it went into development, into a review process.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it got to about the third review before they went... It's too similar to something that we're already doing, or that someone's already pitched to us, or that there was another. It was actually a TV show on. There was a TV show screening about the New Zealand music industry, and they're kind of like, "Well, we didn't really." It was something. The one with Lawton Cora in it. They were in a covers band.
Not sure.
And I was like, "Well, it's got nothing to do with that, really." But anyway, they went. We're not going to take it any further. So that was fine.
So back to me.
So back to you.
Yeah, you met me.
Yes, and then I met you. We went
the
on
clouds parted.
We went on a tour. Where were we? We were going Taupo, I think.
Yes, that sounds right. I remember we're driving from Hamilton.
We were stuck in a car, anyway, in the back seat.
That's right.
And our driver was fucking insane.
No, it wasn't that trip.
It wasn't that trip.
But that trip was bonkers. I remember in the end we took his keys.
Who drove then? Did we take over?
Well, he drove down
to
the gig.
Right.
This is a different gig than what we're talking about.
Okay.
But yeah, we then said, we're not coming back with you unless we can drive.
Yeah.
I think we took turns maybe driving.
We might have. We might have had to have done that. But on one of those trips, we were on the road.
Yeah.
We were touring. Well, I guess we were touring. We were taking a trip to a gig. And we got to talking about
it. Well, that's touring in New Zealand.
Well, I guess so. A tour to me is like, you know, you go from one to the next and then you go to sleep on the way where you
that's
can.
That's the stereotypical touring. But in New Zealand, touring is like a gig a weekend.
Right. Yeah, it has become that way, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And then we got to talking about it. And then I hadn't had the idea of a podcast, but I'd been listening to a lot of podcasts.
Mm.
And then you went, hey, maybe it could be a documentary podcast type of thing.
Yes, because I remember you saying that you had the idea for the documentary, but you couldn't find anybody who was kind of keen to help or whatever.
Yeah.
And then there was the problem with the cost of it. And, you know, a documentary obviously is a much bigger production.
Yeah.
And I said, what about a podcast? And I remember you went, why? And I remember saying, well, if you've got a podcast, immediately you've just almost completely removed all the costs. And also, you don't have to narrow down the number of guests or the subjects you talk about or anything, because it just keeps going. Whereas if you make a documentary, it's what, an hour and a half long.
Yeah.
You've got to really like focus one or two main themes and then have a limited number of guests. And we can cover much more territory on a podcast. So
that's right. Yeah. It's a more long form kind of thing. And so I think you talked me around to that idea. And then I thought I still had the great idea of, well, we could do both. You know, we could set some cameras up.
Yeah.
And then that became a bit cumbersome with all the... But I know that we are now, doing it now.
Yeah.
We are actually
It took us 8 years, but yeah.
but we did... You know, I've actually got a couple of those things that you could use of the... You know, probably there are five interviews there that came out pretty well.
Right,
I just haven't edited them together. You know,
I seen these before?
No, you haven't.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, like we got Nathan Haynes, I think we got well, Greg Haver. You were there.
I was there, yeah.
Yeah, but
I haven't seen the footage, though.
You haven't seen the footage.
We filmed Nathan Haynes.
Yeah, we went to his studio in Parnell.
I remember going there. I just don't remember the filming part of it.
Parnell? Ponsonby.
Yeah, Ponsonby, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be good to see.
And the reason it didn't seem to work at the time was because I had it in my head that I still wanted it to be kind of down the barrel, you know, documentary style.
Right.
Not conversational like this.
Yeah.
And then it became a little bit like, well, okay, so we're doing an hour and a half podcast and then we're asking them to stay around for another hour while we do this.
That's right, because we're going to do it separately.
It's
going to be a different... Oh, right,
more
right,
of
right.
a scripted kind of, you know. So that didn't really work. And I was conscious of, you know, people getting annoyed with us having to do, oh, fuck, you give me one another hour of my time to do this.
Why didn't we think about doing it as the same thing? Like the same.
But you might have said that, and I might have said no.
No, don't be ridiculous,
I
Danny.
I want to be a documentary filmmaker, Danny. Stop it. Don't be ridiculous. And I don't think we did have any gear. I had like two cameras.
Mm.
Didn't have any lighting.
Right.
Didn't use makeup. The sound wasn't great.
We still don't need makeup. What are you talking about?
No, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're so, like George Clooney and Matt Damon. Right,
and then, so it was that for a few years, for a couple of years, I think, or maybe how long was I on the podcast with you for?
Mm, 2 or 3 years.
The podcast as it sort of as evolved over years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went off and had a family. And yep. I do distinctly remember you, and I was kind of offended at the time, to be honest with you.
Oh, good. This is getting to the nitty gritty. What did I say?
Well, I said we were at your house, your other house, your older place.
Yeah.
And we just finished a podcast, and I might have said something like something off the cuff, offhand, like, oh, yeah, got to get home. My wife, you know, wants to have babies or whatever. You know, I was being a bit facetious, but around the time we were trying to have. And you were like, oh, okay, so you're going to start a family. And I think, oh, I said, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, my wife and I got married a couple of years ago, and the idea was to. And then you said something like, well, how's that going to affect the podcast? And I was like, you selfish dick. But then I thought, well, but I also said, I think I remember saying at the time, well, it's not going to have any effect on the
podcast. Right.
You know, like kids sleep, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Apparently. Apparently not.
You assumed.
And you know, I'll still be able to come here and do, you know, the odd thing.
Hmm.
And boy, did that. Was I wrong? That was my first.
There's a long history. I don't remember that at all, but there's, I know I would have said it. And there's a long history to that question or comment that I
made. Oh, right. Okay.
And it's just because one of my constant struggles ever since I started with music is that I was always more committed than everybody else in the team.
Right.
It's always been true. Yeah. I've always worked harder. I've always
And I think that's where I took offense. I think you were inferring that I wasn't as committed as you.
But by now, all these years later, I can sort of see the writing on the wall and go, oh, he's on the way out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I've, I mean, that's sort of it's a tangent, but it's an interesting subject, I think, is trying to become a pro in this industry is really hard when it's an industry basically built on hobbyists or people, not maybe even that's the wrong way to put it, but people who have one foot in, one foot out, because they've, you know, they're a musician, but they've also got a job or whatever. These days, I mean, the musicians I work with are often playing with 15 different bands because they're really good musicians, so they're in demand.
Right.
So then you're like trying to get hold of them, and you have to wait a couple of days, and you know, so there's always been that push and pull. So it's probably not fair for me to think like that.
No, but I get where you were coming from. You did see the writing on the wall.
Yeah.
However bluntly you approached it at the time.
And we were investing. We had started a company and we were putting all this effort in. And wait, what, you're now going to leave? You know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
And this had happened a lot before.
So you were quite right, because then I had to leave the 80s band, the review band.
I thought that's because you didn't like them.
You can't say that on here. They might watch this. No, but that's not true.
Right.
It was just because I just not have the time. I just could not commit the time. And and so I'd like to ask you how you do it now. You've got a kid now, right?
Yeah.
And she's what, two?
Just turned 18 months.
18 months. Mm. And so how does it, how do you find that, juggling that? Because you don't have the conventional day job, so to speak.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually a big part of the answer, is that I am based, you know, here in my home studio.
Mm.
So at any moment, I can get up and walk into the other room and she's there.
Right.
And we both work, my partner and I both work from home, so we don't have to do daycare or anything. So we've just got a different type of life. I mean, it'd be pretty different if I had to go off somewhere else and do like a 40-hour job somewhere.
Yeah.
But this is my job. Music is my job. I'm not doing this and also balancing another job like you are, you know?
Right.
So it's really as simple as that. It's kind of like saying, how do you have time to play gigs? So it's like, well, gigs are my job. When you're at work as an accountant or whatever the person's doing, that's not what I'm doing. You know?
So now you've truncated the name from the original Don't Give Up Your Day Job to
Bringing us back around to
I think it's pertinent to the line of questioning. What's the difference between the kaupapa of that original Don't Give Up Your Day Job, the thinking behind why, the concept of that?
Well, I'll start off with my hesitation. My hesitation is I really believed in what we were doing.
Mm.
And I didn't want to undo the work over all these years. This is not intended to be any kind of dig at the previous name or anything like that. But I have been thinking more and more about how the name has been landing with people. And as you said before, when you told people the truth about your experience as a musician, they were sometimes offended or disappointed or whatever, even though you were telling them the truth.
Yeah.
And I think it's actually a funny thing about Kiwis is we kind of prefer things to be upbeat and positive for a start. And I think that's also been amplified in recent years with all of the horrendous things that have been happening in the world. I think people are a little bit sick of cynical content or negative content. I think ultimately what we were doing was always positive.
Yeah.
Because my argument's always been you can't fix the car until you know what's wrong with it. And right. So we're just simply trying to get to the bottom of what's working and what's not working in the business.
Yeah.
And I've always thought that was crucial, but I don't know if it lands properly with other people. And so I've always felt a little bit out of sync with that, especially because I think it's important, you know, in the spirit of authenticity and so on, you've got to feel like it's an extension of who you are. And, if you're going to, fly the flag, you need to really connect with it, right?
Yeah.
And I just started to feel like maybe I was a negative voice, even though I didn't feel like that was my intention. I feel like maybe that's how it was landing with other people.
Right.
So I was thinking about that authenticity thing and is that just me? Am I just the critical thinker? And that's okay if I am. But is that really who I am? You know? And so I've been thinking about my career over all the years since I started, and I don't think it's who I am. I think critical thinking is a big part of it, but I actually think the more important part of my career has been about problem solving. Because if you were to lay my whole story out, all you would see is a long list of obstacles that I've been methodically working my way around or over or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think that problem solving thing, that's how I figured out how to go full time as a musician and start a business. It's how I sort of put my life together, curated the life that allows me to do this stuff while I have a daughter and so on.
Yeah.
And I think that problem solving thing is really probably more how I want this, I guess on a legacy level, how I see myself and how I'd like the world to know me. Where was I going with that?
Well, the rest of the question, I think you're answering it admirably, is the don't give up. You've kept that side of things. And I think that's great. It's a great call.
And that's what I was going to say is that when we've done 8 years of asking questions and pointing out not only bad things, but, good and the bad, have we actually stopped and thought to talk about solutions? Like, here I am, a full-time musician who's actually figured it out in many ways. Not everything, but just my part of it.
Yeah.
When was the last time I even sat down and, explained how I did it?
Right.
Or some of the solutions? And the same thing for you. You guys achieved what most bands would love to have achieved. There's so much wisdom and advice that we've probably actually never tapped into. Do you know what I mean?
No.
Well, back to me then.
But you're talking about, you're saying solutions approach.
Yeah.
But you can't have solutions without a problem.
Of course.
With something that's wrong.
Oh, I'm not about to turn the show into a show of denial.
Right, okay.
Yeah. No, we'll still talk real talk. That's always going to be the way I talk anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just think that how do we solve problems these days? I'll give you an example. So I was talking to an artist last year. I was working with her a little bit, and she was talking about wanting to be a successful musician and turn it into a career and blah, 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 right? Normal thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I said something about what I was doing and other people I knew, and she kind of blew me off in the sense of but you don't just do original music. You also do session work and covers bands and, podcasts and producer and blah, blah, blah. Like, that was a bad thing.
Right.
You're not really doing it. You're doing it by doing all these other things. And I didn't say anything because I was quite shocked.
Yeah.
But I remember thinking, no, but that's how you do it. Right.
What was her idea of how you do it?
Fantasy garbage. Waiting for a song to go bananas and the money will appear from somewhere.
Right.
And, which is a prevalent idea.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, because people don't know the reality of it.
That's right.
Of what you have to do to, yeah. And And then they see the instances where that appears to be have been the case for
one or two examples of that,
where they've just come out of nowhere and they've had a hit song. But even then, they've most people have worked hard to get where they are. They've done gigs, they've...
And you can't really pay too close attention to exceptions.
Yeah,
you know, that's right. Otherwise you would write a business plan and step one, win lotto, you know.
And so what solutions did you offer this person?
Oh, she wasn't willing. She wasn't interested. Want.
Oh, okay. All right. So,
I got the vibe and I stopped talking.
And so where is she now?
Not doing it? Same place she was before.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Probably sinking money into something.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, that's in itself is one solution. Just sink resources and money until you're broke.
Yeah.
But that's not what you're about. And that's certainly not what I was about. Mm. And that's part of the reason that I... in a way, have given up on the music industry or music because I've had to. I haven't really paid much attention to it. Mm. I'm kind of away from it now, which has been both
actually
a release.
I don't remember if we've drilled down into that. I mean, I know that things were strained with the band, and I know that your priorities shifted to your family.
Yeah.
But is there an alternate universe where you still had that drive for music, and you would found a way of making it work? Let's say...
pause for effect.
Yeah, maybe you joined a different band. Everything was sweet. It was on the way up.
I don't think so. No, okay. I didn't even think... from the vantage point of where I am now, there's a practical side to it too. Like, for instance, I've got a drum kit at home.
Mm.
I hadn't touched a pair of sticks for almost a year and a half. Like, literally hadn't picked them up.
Right.
I think the first time that's not entirely true. There was a time. I had one gig in the last, I guess, 12 months. It was a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, a good friend of the band's actually, and people I've played with for years and years and years. Down in Christchurch, 50th birthday. He had a whole band set up there of gear. It was on the premises of a place that we'd. Well, there's no original places left in Christchurch that were being bowled by the earthquake, but the Ducks Deluxe, they'd moved premises, and we had a good relationship with them in their original. So anyway, we went and played in their new place. They gave us some space. They gave us the area to do it. And we just jammed until 3 a.m, until we got told to shut the
I think I remember up. This happening.
So that's the first time I picked up a pair of sticks, probably in the year or a year and a half to that. And then since then, I haven't. So that was back in May 2023.
Mm.
So that's the only time that I'd pick up a pair of sticks. But recently, I tried to go in there and I thought, I should... because every time I walk past my little studio, office, home studio thing, I look at the door and I'm like, will I go in there? Should I do anything? And I just... I haven't got the energy today to keep walking. Got other things to do. Got my job, my day job, my kids, whatever.
Mm.
But I did go in there and pick up a pair of sticks and I was... absolutely exhausted in about 5 minutes, like trying to play along with.
But that's just because you're out of practice.
I don't. That's my point, though. Yeah. I don't think I've got the patience or the willpower anymore to get back into game shape. So if I had a gig or a tour tomorrow, I'd have to turn it down because I just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And that's part of another part of the reason. Actually, the '80s band thing. Now that I think about it, was I think that there was a push to learn a whole new set of songs.
Yeah.
30 songs,
mm-hmm.
And I don't know. And you might have a solution for this. So not that it's useful for me now, but at the time, I was looking down the barrel of learning 30 new songs, having the full-time job, having a new baby.
Mm.
And for me, and you've probably noticed this and you've never said anything. Well, I think you did say something to me once about it. And I think you know the song I'm going to talk about, Girls on Film.
Okay.
There's a particular part of that song where I keep screwing the part up. There's maybe an extra beat in a bar or something out of the guitar solo.
Wow.
And it keeps throwing you off.
This was a few years ago now. I don't remember.
So here's my... let's shelve that and come back to it. Well, it's relevant, so we probably don't have to go too far from it. But my way of learning a song is I'll sit with the song for days and just listen to it over and over and over. And not thinking about structure, not thinking about parts.
Right.
Just listen to the song, get a feel for it. But I'm also really lazy in that I don't want to learn the song note for note.
Right.
I want to have some creative part of it and to sort of do it the way that I want to do it.
Yeah.
But keeping as close as possible to the, so that people still recognize it as the song.
Yep.
And so I don't transpose, I don't write parts out, transcribe parts. I don't sit down and go, I normally try and get a feel for the structure of it rather than writing it down on paper or anything like that at all.
Mm.
So I'll listen to it for a few days. And then I'll come back to it and start thinking about structure, you know, still not writing. I never write anything down as such. Then I'll go through and I'll listen to certain sections and I'll learn those sections and then I'll start playing along to the sections.
Right.
And that's how I learn a song.
Yeah.
By this point, I'm 4 or 5 days in and I've only learned one song.
Right.
Right. So that's a slow process. Yeah. And even slower with the whole day job thing and the kids and whatever. You know, you sometimes don't get a chance to sit down until 9, 10 o'clock at night.
Sure. Yeah.
So am I going to listen to 30 fucking song?
Yeah.
So I was mapping it out in my head going, 30 of those, it's going to take me 30 weeks to learn 30 new songs. I can't do it. You know, the band's not going to wait for me to do that. I don't have the time or energy to do it. Not going to do it.
Right.
So my question to you is, what's the solution? How do you learn? How would you, for a guitar student, how would you tell them, like they're not new, but they've been at it a while, how would you say to them, here's how I would suggest you learn a song?
Oh, I mean, I have a process. I mean, what I teach is my process, and I've refined it over years. But I do very much lean into structure. I chart the whole song up to start with, and I do like a non-detailed quick kind of overview, just basically get bar structures and chord changes and whatever. And then I focus on what are the memorable parts, the parts that are important on a structural level, the parts we couldn't live without, the parts that the audience would really want to hear, that they'd remember, you know, those moments.
The one they're looking forward to.
Yeah.
The Phil Collins song.
Exactly, yeah.
And if that wasn't in there, they go, well, that's not the
song. Or if you made it radically different. You know, that would be disappointing to a lot of people or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, so there's, if you separate those moments from the rest of the song, you realize that there's actually only kind of a few of those things, the really notable, important bits. And then the rest of it, you can sort of improvise a little bit more. A lot of gigs I've had like 35 songs on a list in a week to learn them. So I've had to speed my whole process up. So you have to sort of do a trade off and go, well, I'll hit all the important bits and the rest of it, I'll just improv.
Right.
And make good decisions and make it work, listen to the band and keep the energy up and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The note for note thing, I think that's a trap. I don't think that's, like, for example, as a guitar player, you're often learning songs that have actually got 5 guitar parts on them.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. And they've only hired you.
Different tones, different...
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That as well. All the different effects and tones and different guitars and things. Mm-hmm. But also, how do you get 5 guitar parts onto one guitar?
Yeah.
It's something I think I'm actually pretty good at, but I've had a few occasions over the years where band leaders have said, no, that's not how the original goes. And I'm like, yeah, but the original was 5 guitars, you know? Yeah. I mean, I remember having this debacle with this guy many years ago on the song Sex on Fire by Kings of Leon.
Yeah.
And in the chorus, there's this really high guitar part that goes up, but it still has the chunky rhythm guitars down the bottom.
Yeah.
And then in the song, it's also reinforced with heaps of like pads and synths and things like that. And this was basically like a trio sort of situation. And so I think I decided to play the high melody on a lower octave so I could also play the chords at the same time.
Oh, okay.
And he went, that's not right. The guitars have to go high. And I went, that's cool. I can go high if you want me to. But if I'm playing that chunky verse and then I go high, all the guts will fall out of it.
Mm.
And he goes, it has to go high. Great. So I played it high and he goes, no, now all the guts are falling out of it. I'm like, exactly. You know, and we went round and round in circles and he was never happy with anything.
Right.
And it was impossible to answer. So
yep.
My approach to all this stuff, I think if you're trying to go note for note, I think you end up playing too mechanically, you're too in your head, and
yes,
you usually can't recreate it anyway because you don't have the same gear,
yep,
the same feel, you don't have the same personality on the instrument.
Yep.
It's just not possible, and it's arguably pointless. My process has always been to replicate the feeling of the song, to give the audience what they want. If they know the song is punk rock and, you know, whatever, make it punk rock.
Right.
It doesn't have to be exactly the same series of downstrokes and upstrokes as what was on the record.
Right.
That's my approach anyway.
I always felt I was disappointing you in that song when we did Girls on Film. And it would throw me off too because I'm like, oh, here's that part coming up. Okay, I've got to make sure that... And then fuck it up. And I'm like, oh, okay, no, it's gone now. I missed it.
Ah, bonjour. Small businesses are the lifeblood of our economy. We pride ourselves in our agility, innovation, and can-do attitude. But sometimes there simply isn't enough time in the day to get everything done. That's where Overflow Support comes in. Overflow Support can help support you with those day-to-day tasks that fall by the wayside when times get busy. Anything from data entry, content management, to desktop research, Overflow support are here to help. Check them out at www.overflowsupport.co.nz.
I did grieve losing my music career. I think we were talking about this with my wife a few months ago, probably weeks ago now. You know, there was a time where I just when I had to get the full time day job to support the mortgage and whatever.
Right.
And I grieved. I think I grieved.
And is that grieving like an identity? Because we all grow up, like, it's not just a thing we do, it's a way we see ourselves, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's also, I think, what I've come to learn is that it was also the way that I feel like other people saw me, too.
Right, yeah.
Like, you know, that not only was it part of my identity, personal identity, it was part of a public identity that people were kind of like, well, that band that did so well, what have they done lately? Where are they at?
So is that also the dynamic? Like, you because you guys got to such a great height, did it sort of feel like failure then? Or admitting defeat or something?
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think I've ever admitted defeat on it.
Right.
More that
I wouldn't say that would just be fair if that was the case. I'm just, you know.
No, I don't think so. But it was more the fact that this thing's gone now from my life, out of either necessity or it's just it doesn't fit into the path of where my life's going.
Yeah.
But then I've spent 30 years building that identity, I felt, not just in that band, but as a musician, as a career. You know, I'm a strong believer in every single gig you've ever played, good or bad, has led to you where you are now.
Absolutely.
100%. Almost every person you've ever met and that's made an impact on you in your life, every bit of pop culture or whatever, it all feeds into the machine that makes you the person or the musician that you are, I feel.
Right.
And to suddenly have that go away and it's not there anymore, and almost overnight, I'm kind of like, what do I do now? I feel lost. You kind of a little bit lost. I didn't realize that at the time is what it was that I was feeling. Because you wouldn't normally, maybe you do associate grief with that kind of thing, but I hadn't made the connection until recently.
Yeah.
And I think, more I was grieving that, like, having lost a part of that, what I thought was who I am. And then now, months and months later, I'm kind of like, actually, I've got other things I need to be moving on with, and I don't feel like it's a big, which is also in a way a bit of a shame and a bit of a shock to the system to realize it's not part of who I am anymore, I don't think. I don't think I feel like I want to make music anymore. I don't feel like I need to, you know, because there was a point where I was just, I needed to do that.
Yeah.
Something I needed to do.
Yeah. I mean, I've had a lot of the same thought processes, even though I am still in music. I think I experienced moments of that sort of grief when certain projects ended, or when I just got to points in my career where I realized things weren't going to work the way I thought they might work out. And I think there was a point, which probably in some ways ended up informing this podcast, where... And I don't even know when this was or exactly how it worked, but I think it was a slow realization that the music industry isn't as it seems, and the goal that most of us grew up having, or the fantasy most of us had, wasn't real.
Yeah.
And, I mean, for the odd exception, it might happen to work out that way.
But even then, I don't think it's real.
Not really, inside, you know? Yeah. So I think when I realized that, part of me was disappointed. I sort of grieved that in a way. But I think the other part of me became determined to get to the bottom of it. So what's really going on here? And that started to become the way that I thought.
Right.
And I think that's probably why when you started talking about the idea for the show, it landed right on that for me. I'm like, we should do that. You know, we should talk about that, because I'm actually genuinely curious.
Right.
Like, I want to know, why is that person there and that person struggling, and, you know, that person doesn't have much to offer as far as I can tell, but they're seemingly held up on a pedestal.
Yeah.
And this incredibly talented person is at the pub and no one cares. And, you know, there's so much about this that doesn't add up.
Uh-huh.
And so I just wanted to learn more about it. Now I feel like I've probably learned too much and I can't stop thinking about it.
But the other thing that every now and then something will pop up on social media that will make me a little bit envious. I guess, I mean, it's not nice to say that you're jealous of something, but you know, when you see your mates out there on tours, or people you know you've associated with over the years doing a big summer tour, like LAB's out there doing this, you know, killing it at the moment, or the Feelers have just gone on a tour, summer tour. You're out there releasing albums, and I'm kind of like, oh man, Part of me wishes I was still doing that, but actually less and less these days, a smaller part of me, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think...
There was a line that Stuart Copeland said when the police broke up and someone said, do you miss touring? And he said, when I was on tour, I missed being home 95% of the time. But when I'm home, I miss being on tour 5% of the time. And I thought that sort of nailed it perfectly.
Yeah, I've heard another quote, and I don't even know. I'll butcher it, but I also don't know who it was that said it.
Yeah.
About it might have been like, I want to say Don Henley, but I don't know.
Right.
I'm not going to attribute it to anyone, really. But you know, people saying I've never missed not doing a show, but
right.
I miss my family. You know,
yes.
when I'm on tour.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I guess in a way that I'm less and less. Down about that kind of thing now.
You know, the other thing that I've been thinking about, which I think is, here's a solution for you.
Okay.
And for me, this was part of
just get over it, mate.
Yeah, exactly. Just pull your socks up. For me, you know, obviously through the COVID thing, a lot of us were reflecting and whatever. And for me, part of it was actually, I started to realize that I kind of have an opportunity here because... As much as, you know, I've always loved music and I've been super driven to be in it and whatever, that's something that I've been thinking about and working towards. I don't even know when it started. Like, it probably goes in some vague form all the way back to when I could first talk,
right.
You know, because I remember being like 3 or 4 and listening to music and like, that's what I want to do. Right. And, you know, there is a universe where that was all I ever did and that was the end of my life. But I actually kind of have a chance to have another life. I have a chance to have other experiences and to be interested in other things and to not be, as much as there's so much about music I love, there's an opportunity here to be free from the obsession and the frustration and the ambition. It's actually nice to stop being ambitious for a while.
Because
ambition can help in so many ways, but it can also be incredibly toxic.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree 100%.
And I think that's where I am now with my music, and we've got the album out and so on, is that I feel more free about it. It's like we really like the album we made. We think it's great. We're going to go out and play shows. We're doing all that stuff, but we're doing it with this kind of ease now because we've sort of got nothing to prove.
Right.
And... our goal was just to make an album we liked, and that was it. So we've already won. Do you know what I mean? So we're able now to sort of finally shake off all that
extra stuff.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's an age thing.
Probably.
You know, and I mean that, you know, I'm not being facetious about it. I'm in a way that you just care less about what people think.
Yep.
My wife and I recently have started Vedic meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So in the last 6 months, and I'm not the best at practice. I will miss a couple of sessions a day. You know, you do it twice a day, 20 minutes each time. But one of the benefits that I found from it is that I actually care less about what other people think.
Yeah.
And I think that's a benefit from it, but it could be an age thing. I don't know.
Mm.
And less stressed about. Particular thing, not everything.
Right.
I'm not at that point yet. Anyway, I'm sure there are people out there who are stress free. But no, yeah, I just don't care so much.
And is that also? I think for me, that's also like realizing that other people are. Firstly, other people don't have it together like you think they do. I think we always assume everyone else has got their life together.
Yeah.
And everyone else is cool and happy. And that's the social media vibe, isn't it? Of everyone puts their best face forward and you go, oh man, everyone else is killing it, you know? What's wrong with me?
Yeah.
But realizing maybe this is also what age helps you see, if you've had more time to see it and notice it and think about it, is that, you know, everyone's struggling and everyone's in the same place in many ways. And there's no reason to worry about anyone else thinks because most people aren't thinking about you in the first place.
No, that's the thing.
And if they are, they're probably seeing you through the same broken lens and going, man, Bobby is so happy and together. What's wrong with me?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So us worrying about what other people think is it's sort of redundant.
One of the things I'm trying to teach my kids conceptually, if not, you know, word for word, but the idea of what other people thinking about you is none of your business.
Yeah.
You can't control it. You shouldn't be worrying about that.
Mm.
More worry. Don't stop comparing yourself to other. That's the thing my daughter's doing at the moment. It's like, you know, my friend at school is so much better at gymnastics than I am. Her little brother it takes a lot more risks than she does. Like, he'll climb up high on one of the, and he's only 4 years old, but he'll climb to the top of the climbing frame in the school playground, whereas she won't.
Right.
She's a little bit more, a little safer, yep. You know, and he'll take more risks. Yeah, I was like, don't compare yourself to other people, because that's pointless. There's always going to be someone who's better at you than some things, yep. And you're always going to be better than others at some things. And
I've thought about that a lot. I mean, I was really impacted by that type of thinking in the past. I had a lot of critical voices in my childhood, and not much of the opposite.
Right.
So basically, for the first 20 years of my life, I just had people telling me what was wrong with me, basically.
Right.
And it's hard to shake off that internal dialogue if it's been planted in you like that. So I've really worked on that subject, on that problem. But it's funny, because something I think that's true about me is that I was always the sort of kid that stood out. Like, I was never able to blend into the crowd,
right?
Because I was always pretty independent, and I never had that muscle in my brain that went, do the thing you need to do to fit in. Like, if everyone was buying the same t-shirt, I would just not buy it because I thought it was lame to conform, you know.
Yeah.
So I wasn't doing myself any favors. But the things that the parts of my personality that made me a target ended up being the parts of my personality that made me successful.
Right.
And that's something I've then thought a lot about after all these years, is that in my, I don't know if this was the same for your, where you were, but where I was, showing any kind of drive or ambition or showing that you cared about something was seen as lame.
Yeah.
So the way to be cool was to be aloof and like, whatever.
Don't care.
You know. Or this turning, like taking this sort of too cool for school cynicism thing and just turning it up to high.
Yeah.
And I remember way back then just going, that's so stupid. You know, like I've got things I want to do. And I was putting bands together and organizing rehearsals and writing songs and booking gigs and, you know, and it never actually made me cool in that environment, even though quite rightly it probably should have made me cool, because I was actually doing things.
Yeah.
But it kind of went against me because I was never aloof.
It'd be interesting to see where those people are now, the ones who are, oh, you're too lame, you know, you're so, stop doing that, stop trying to be cool. Where are they now in their life, you know?
Oh, I mean, I'm aware of where some of them are, and I think I think karma has worked out just the right way.
One of the things I've been thinking about a lot lately, and it's partly because there's a project at my day job that we're thinking about these sorts of things, but you know, the importance of arts and creativity. You know, why is it important?
Yeah.
Is it important?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's not to some people, but even from a cultural lens, and especially like the word culture in this country is quite a loaded word.
Yeah, I was just about to ask you to qualify what you mean by culture.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, culture is, you know, a system of beliefs or of things, at least as I understand it, that that societies, they do things a certain way, and then that kind of...
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I would have described it differently.
Please do.
I mean, I guess I have two versions of culture in my mind. I know that culture is often assigned to whichever country you're in. It's assigned to the indigenous people of that country.
No, that's ethnicity, though.
Okay, sure. I've never thought about it that way. I've sort of understood some people to mean it that way, is what I mean.
Okay,
but I think about culture, I think about just the experiences we have growing up. So I've always thought of culture as including all of pop culture too. Like all of us, when you and I, our generation, there are TV shows and movies and music, and all of that is part of our culture as well.
Yeah.
And Weet-Bix and fish and chip shops and Jandals and beaches and, you know, as well as the more kind of meaningful things, you know?
Yeah. I think I wondered whether the part of the people think in this country that culture immediately means Maori or Pacific or whatever, and they kind of withdraw from that because they're a little bit afraid to not, they don't want to, they don't understand it, they don't know anything about the cultures in that reference to the word,
right?
And so they're a little bit afraid to even broach the subject. But anyway, the reason why was I bringing this up? Oh, there was a thing you said before around, you know, not doing the things the same as everybody else, and why wouldn't you want to stand out? And it kind of relates to me to the use of Te Reo Māori in the culture at large in New Zealand, but also, you know, in the kind of political culture we found ourselves in with the, and I don't want to get political on it because either way, it's going to cause some issues, but we currently find ourselves in winding back some of the, what I find have been gains over the last 40 years with acknowledging the Te Reti o Waitangi and the Te Reo Māori use of the language and whatnot.
Yeah.
And it, but then there are a certain sect of people who recoil at the, even the concept of that and feel like they're having that foisted upon them or shoved down their throats kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I take a different view on it, partly because I do fuck a papa Māori. I have Māori ancestry in me, but not just that. I mean, I feel like I would be, by ignoring that side of part of me, then I'd be kind of disrespecting my nan, who I love very, very much. Mm. But not just that. But my view on it is, why wouldn't you want to embrace something that makes this country unique from the rest of the world? It's not going to, it doesn't mean that we're going to, we do have certain parts of settler culture that have, or part of the life that we live in this country.
Yeah.
That's always going to be there. The colonization is the word I was trying to avoid using it, but that's the only colonizers kind of the word. But that doesn't mean that that's going to be disregarded. Why can't it be a part of the culture? Why can't we embrace, as I understand it, the way that the Te Reti o Waitangi was signed and why it was important, why aren't we using that to stand out from the rest of the world? Well, I mean, it's the only thing that's really unique about New Zealand.
Right.
Because you don't find the culture, the Māori culture and the language and the practices and anywhere else in the world.
Right.
And it's here. It's the home. This is the home of it.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't we embrace it and use it as a way to... I mean, it's not meant to be, okay, this is it now. This is what you're going to do.
Mm.
Culture evolves over time. You know, a country should evolve. Languages evolve.
Yeah.
And I feel like we've got an opportunity to be different.
Yeah.
You know, not why... I don't want to be known as like a little version of the UK or England or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. Without also dissing our past or our ancestry or whatever.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with that. I mean, obviously it's a pretty hot subject.
And let's not go too far into it
because exactly,
whether we're qualified to is another question.
But. Well, I mean, I don't agree with that idea. I don't agree with the idea that one should only speak about the thing that they are personally attached to. I think that's completely crazy. You know, I mean, I can say that the Holocaust was wrong. I don't have to be Jewish to know that.
The what,
you know?
Sorry?
The denier comes out.
I'm not a denier, by the way.
No.
Being controversial.
But what I mean, with there's so many subjects out there, not just that one, there's all sorts of subjects about
like identity, politics,
exactly, all that stuff. I tend to stay away from a lot of it on the podcast, mainly because it's not what the podcast is about. But I think there are some subjects out there where I do just sort of take a step back and I'm just listening and thinking and trying to work it out. If I'm not sure about something, I tend to not weigh in on it.
As well, I think you should.
Exactly.
That's my view on it.
My feeling, though, overall, like the sort of thing that I would, well, what I'd want to say, I guess, to most of these subjects is I wish everybody would just bring the volume down and listen to each other more. Things are not black and white, and there are not two sides to these things. You know, like there was the argument with the voice vote in Australia recently. Did you follow that?
No.
There was a vote in Australia, the same day that we had our election here, actually. They were voting a thing called The Voice, which was an idea of building into the Constitution in Australia some kind of committee that would represent Indigenous people, First Nation people in Australia, and that would be a voice that were going to take part in decisions on all sorts of different things. But it became a very divided issue, and it went to vote and it got obliterated.
Yes, I actually do I do recall it.
What I thought was interesting about that debate was that it was being pitched as non-racist versus racist, but in actual fact there were lots of different points of view, and it was far more nuanced than that.
But those are the two, you know, standout positions that people can pitch their tent on that hill, and that's the you'll find that in American politics probably more than there's a divide there, right? It's a pretty you could get a clearer divide. I didn't think we were going to go down the Trump thing, but maybe we don't have to.
But I think the point still actually applies to that. I think I think that's why now they're not just saying left and right, they're saying far left and left and then and center and then right and then far right. You know, they're, it's actually starting to fall apart a little bit. I just think if everyone just turn the volume down and listen to each other a bit more and understand that if someone is against something, it doesn't mean that they're racist. They actually might have just a They might even not have a good reason. They just might be still thinking it through. And to constantly accuse everyone of everything, all that does is cause more division.
But then you've got the you've got the fringe voices out there who sell newspapers and
need the headlines.
And they're really only a small part of the population.
Yeah.
But you've got the extreme groups on either side of that.
Yeah.
But part of me is like, who's advising these people, and because some of the things they're saying are just outright bonkers.
Yeah.
But they have to say they've got these talking points that they need to get across, and you don't have time to go into the nuance or the thinking behind it.
Yes.
So
that's where the system's broken.
Yeah.
And we need to have more nuance. The main thing I wanted to talk about, though, apart from our new album, Noise Play, it's called Junk, look it up now, is Indiana Jones. I think that you weren't that excited by the new movie, and I really liked it. I just feel like we should argue about Indiana Jones.
Okay, let's go there. So this is Indiana Jones, the fifth installment. What did you think of the fourth one? Let's start with the easy one.
Oh, I mean, that sucked.
Sucked. Why? What was sucky about it?
That's a good question. Why did it suck?
I mean, it had all the elements of a good Indiana Jones film, right? You had, you had the intro where that new term came from, nuked the fridge.
That's right.
But you had, you had the intro, and then you had it sort of veering off into the main story, and then you had the MacGuffin, the thing they're chasing after, the thing they want to capture, and which was the crystal skulls in that one. Eh?
Right.
But so I don't know, why didn't it work?
Yeah, I'm not sure. That's a good. I mean, I think the fridge thing was hard to take because it was obviously so beyond, you know. And the other movies aren't exactly based on reality, but I don't know. It just seemed so far over the line. It was like, what?
Yeah.
there's no way. I don't know. I didn't vibe with the spaceship.
Right.
I actually haven't seen the movie in so long. I'm desperately now trying to remember what is in the
movie.
All I remember
is
that vine scene with them swinging through the vines.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which was pretty stupid.
they were clearly trying to set him up as the predecessor.
Right.
Or the person to take over from
Indiana
Jones.
Before he had a go at Steven Spielberg and fell out with him.
Yeah, and then they killed him off in the next movie, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the two most successful ones,
that's
Temple of Doom and Last Crusade, right?
Last Crusade, yeah.
The MacGuffin in those ones were, I guess, rooted in a Judeo-Christian kind of world view, or rather, the relics were from a Judeo-Christian belief system, Ark of the Covenant and the Holy Grail.
Holy Grail, yeah.
Right. Whereas the Shankara stones in Temple of Doom. Sorry, did I say Temple of Doom? Raiders of the Lost Ark was the first one. Right,
yes.
Raiders of the Lost Ark and Last Crusade.
Yeah.
So you've got those two, which are Christian relics.
Mm.
And then you've got the Shankara stones, which were, Indian. And then what was the Crystal Skulls one? So I feel like they weren't so popularly known as or intrinsic to the cultures that go to the movies to see these things.
Right.
Maybe they weren't as popular. So this one, again, it's a relic from, the Antikythera? What is it? The Dial of Destiny, whatever they called it in this one.
Yeah.
Again, another completely non. So I feel like those other ones where people, you've already got a built-in audience because they know in some regard, it's related to Jesus. And then they've got Nazis in that one. So they brought the Nazis back. Yeah. You've got Nazis in those two great ones, and then you've got the Nazis back for this one. So in that regard, the elements that came, they've obviously gone through, what are the great elements? Let's pull them into this the fifth installment.
Yeah.
I did like things about it. I certainly did like the Nazi angle the first 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That was a classic Indiana Jones film as far as I'm concerned.
Yep.
And then we got into a little bit of the, the reason that I didn't like the fifth movie, I think, was I went down the road of learning too much about it before watching it. And normally when I do that in a film, it doesn't affect me as much.
Right.
I was just so excited about it coming out and seeing it, that I wanted to know everything I could beforehand. And that was a mistake because there were so many people, there was so much rumor around because they had to reshoot the last third of the film.
Oh, did they?
The test screenings didn't go so well with audiences, so they had to rethink the whole thing, rewrite the script, reshoot it.
Mm-hmm.
So that wasn't a good, and it got delayed because of that, but also got delayed because of COVID lockdowns as well, they're saying. So I think I looked at too many things beforehand, and I got into that kind of frame of mind of that thinking.
I actually didn't know when I was a kid that the Temple of Doom was considered to be a bit of a flop. I just, when I was a kid, I just loved all three movies.
Right.
And Crusade was always my favourite one.
Yeah.
I just think Crusade had everything. Yeah. Sean Connery was great.
Amazing. Yeah.
And I think there's a, with so many of these movies, it's hard to get back to a movie that was such a big part of your childhood.
Yeah.
Like, I saw an image actually earlier today of the original cast from the first original Star Wars movie. And I, and it gave me that same chill, like, you know, oh yes, you know. And I just thought they're never going to land it the same way ever again. Because we've got so much sentiment and emotion, everything attached to that, and memory and so on.
Yeah.
But also, and I've thought a lot about this actually in terms of music as well, the influences of every single person involved in making it, not just the actors and the director, but every the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that are involved in making these films are all influenced by the time that they're in. And so the people making the first Star Wars film and the first Indiana Jones films, you know, they're in the 70s and early 80s.
Trailblazers.
And yeah, and they're influenced by the music that's out then and the TV shows that are out then. And, you know, so you, I think sometimes you look back and you, you see these things as like isolated projects. Like Indiana Jones is just Indiana Jones, but you don't realize that Indiana Jones was coming out in the movies at the same time as some other big movie, and they had just finished watching this other movie, and it was all, everything was influencing everything.
Yep.
And we live in a world now where everything is still influencing everything.
Mm-hmm.
And social media and TikTok videos are probably actually influencing the way big production movies are being made, in a, even if it's a subconscious thing. Do you know what I mean? It's just the kind of zeitgeist has changed.
Yep.
So they will never make it the same way.
No.
And they arguably shouldn't.
No, they just can't. They just can't. Really can't.
Yeah.
However much they try.
What they should do is write new movies and stop remaking old movies.
But, you know, the whole idea of an Indiana Jones film was also made from old movies, like serial adventure films that George Lucas watched as a kid, you know,
the ones
with Errol Flynn and literally swinging on vines through the trees.
Or like the Star Wars thing, they made a Western, a Cowboy Western movie in space. Which is just perfect. It's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
Well, anyway, my thing on Indiana Jones was that I knew nothing about it going in. I knew nothing. I didn't know that. I don't know how much about it I should say. Spoiler alert. I didn't know about the time travel thing. I didn't know anything about it. I think
everyone who was going to see it seen it by now. Right?
Probably, yeah. I think I was late to it, actually. Right. I didn't know anything about it. I just got the feels. I went into it.
Yep.
It was action. It was exciting. It was funny. It was Indiana Jones, you know, and I just immediately was in. I was excited. I couldn't wait to see what happened, and I just got the same buzz I used to get off those movies.
Right.
And I'm sure I could watch it again and pull it apart, but I was just like, actually, I just want to enjoy this one.
Yeah, I think I pulled it apart too much beforehand, but I'm, you know, I may go and revisit it. I never revisited Crystal Skull.
I think I watched it again and it sucked more.
Right.
Is that possible?
You would think that because there are billions of dollars at risk, you know, that they would have, you know, and these movies are to a certain extent accused of being formulaic, as it is. But you'd think they'd have it down pat by now. But you just, maybe it just goes to show this: you never know what's going to land with people, what's going to resonate with them. And the thing is, they're at the point now. I mean, case in point being the opening 20 minutes, that's where I got the feels. I was like, this is an Indiana Jones movie.
Yeah.
Because you saw the young Harrison Ford.
But what about the tuk-tuk chase? Didn't you love that? That was amazing.
But that's part of the formula thing I'm thinking of, because I immediately thought of the minecart chase in Temple of Doom, the similar, you know. So they had one of those in the Crystal Skull too.
That does bug me, actually. Nods to previous things is a modern phenomenon.
Yeah.
That I really, it really irritates me. Just make a new movie.
Yeah, that's
just,
right.
Just
make
a good story. We don't need you to keep reminding us that there was a different movie in the past.
Yeah. I mean, subtle hints.
Yeah.
Some people get a thriller that go, oh, there's an Easter egg. I saw that, and maybe no one else saw it.
Yeah,
you know, because there was one in that movie, the Star Wars one. Mm-hmm. You know, with the old fighter plane with the window that was shaped like the Empire Strikes Back. There were a few things in there that people kind of went, oh, I know, I can tell what that is all about. they can be cute, but if there's too many of them, you're like, okay, we get it. It's a It's an Indiana Jones film. We know that.
Why not subscribe? It'll make your life better. The way that we're looking at the music industry in terms of the ideal stereotypical version of success that most people, I think, assume is out there to find, which arguably probably never was there, and at least these days it's not there the way you'd think it would be. So what we have to do is either leave the business or adapt and sort of renegotiate your relationship with music, which is what I've had to do. I had a moment, I had an epiphany some years ago because I thought that I'd failed in music. I didn't reach the commercial success I was looking for and so on. I thought I'd failed. I felt, you know, really disappointed. That's it. I'm out. I'm going to leave the music industry. And then I couldn't think of what to do. So I was like, okay, I'm going to have to think about this. And then I realized the problem was is that I'm a full-time musician. And so it wasn't just a case of like not putting out more music. I had to find another income. And then it made me realize like, wait a minute, my income is music. I haven't completely failed. And then I realized that all of the different activities that I do in music, I had actually built a professional career. And that is successful.
That is successful,
So I had to sort of recalibrate and renegotiate my concept of what success meant. And then I had to ask myself, am I prepared? Do I love music enough and still want to be in music enough to keep doing all that stuff? Or am I just not into it anymore enough to have the drive to do that stuff? And at that point I decided, no, I'm still in. I want to do it. And so I just basically let go of one little thing and then focused on what I was already doing. Sounds like you kind of had the same experience and perhaps decided, it wasn't that you decided you didn't like music anymore. It's just you decided that, I mean, you tell me.
It wasn't serving me the same way it was. And I didn't need that anymore.
And you didn't want to put that same amount of drive into it.
I didn't want to put that kind of effort. I didn't need to put it in anymore. I didn't really... and part of it not playing as often is a thing. I've always played in bands with people. I've always, you know, collaborated. And when that kind of goes away, then the impetus to do it seems to evaporate and dry up a little bit. That's not to say in the future might get to start to do gigs again, but I'd have to do probably 6 months of training or 6 weeks of cardio or something.
You could, though. I remember one sound check that we did. Actually, it was a few sound checks, but you used to put on this like Latin groove or something and warm up to it.
Oh, yeah.
The background music you used to use.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time you did that, and you were just going for it. And I was like, oh my God, I didn't know he was that good a drummer. Because like often what our experiences are as musicians is what you're actually doing on the gig is pretty basic.
Yeah.
And what you're really capable of as a musician, you almost never get to do on stage. And that felt like a glimpse for me, like, wow, this is Bobby really doing what he can do.
For me, that kind of thing, being, you know, same thing you could say about guitarists, it's really, it's all well and good being able to shred, but knowing what's right for the song or the piece or that's the important thing. And I always, my ethos was over practice and, you know, so that you can deliver what you need to deliver.
I thought you were going to say over practice, under deliver.
Well, no, but that could be, you could construe it that way.
It's almost right.
I remember someone told me in a, someone I played with in a band, the singer of the Stereobus was once like, you know, the thing I like about your style is you'll play what's right for the song and what feels like the best thing to do.
Yeah.
But every now and then you can just open your coat and say, actually, I've got this, all this sort of stuff I can do as well.
Yeah.
That might come from the jazz background. So a little bit of flash every now and then doesn't really hurt.
I also think, though, there's a principle that what you bring to the stage needs to be about 60%, 70% of your ability. I think if you're playing at 100%, you're doomed.
Yeah.
Because you're never going to relax or be comfortable. Your feel's going to be off. You're on the verge of making a mistake and whatever. You need to have such a level of ease with what you're playing on stage that you actually, if your goal is to play here, you need to get your ability up to there, even though you're never going to use that bit. Just so that's actually at a level of ease.
That's a good way of saying it. Yeah, because that's the thing that I need to be at a place of ease and not in my head thinking about what has to come next or what's the flashiest thing I can do here to stand out. No, you've got to deliver your part of the, certainly as a drummer or even a rhythm section, you're there to support what's happening with the rest of the song and make sure it makes sense to people out there who are dancing to it or who are who might be more inspired by the lyrics or the sound or whatever, the melody.
Right.
But, not getting in the way of the song the way that it's meant to be. That's the way I'd like to approach it.
Yeah.
But oftentimes you get in the way by by overthinking it and making mistakes along
the way. So. Or doing something that I've only ever seen you do, which is fall asleep while playing the drums.
When did that happen?
That happened, I think we were playing in Masterton, and someone, I think, really? Clint yelled at me, like, look at him, and like mid-show. Like the crowd's going nuts, and I look over, and you're literally like, you're still playing, yeah, but you're just fast asleep.
I can play drums in my sleep.
And one of the crew ran over and gave you a beer, and you woke up. That, I still to this day don't know how that works.
That has happened before, though.
All right. Well, it's been great to catch up.
Yeah,
we've gone too long, as we always do, because it's too much fun.
Fair enough. Yeah.
But what I would like to tell you is, don't give up. There are solutions.
Okay.
And if you ever need to know what they are, I'll let you know.
Thank you.
I guess I have to go and figure out what they are exactly, but I'll keep you posted.
You should do that. You should be a music consultant for people. Charge for it.
And do what?
Consult. Give them solutions to their... I mean, you tried with that other person. I think I know who it is that you're talking about. We won't mention her name.
We'll talk about that off mic.
Yeah. There's something in that. People want to hear from you. They want your advice. You've done this. You've made the mistakes. You've fallen over on your ass. You've got up.
Steady,
you do things.
Steady.
No, you probably haven't fallen over. But
many times.
Good stuff, man. No, it's been great to be back. I'm probably the most recurring guest on your show. It's your show now. It's yours.
I guess it is now because I changed the name of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't give up.
Don't give up.
Don't give up. Okay. I'll try and remember that.
Yep. Yep.
Good stuff, man. Well, all the best with the day. Good luck.
Thank you.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right.
Cool. Till next year.
All right, mate.
You've been listening to Don't Give Up, hosted by me, Danny McCrum. If you prefer visual stimulation, you can watch this episode on YouTube. The extension is at Don't Give Up Pod. If you enjoyed the show, tell a friend and help us spread the word. We can have a good time together. And while you're at it, hit like, subscribe, leave a comment and a review. Let's grow this thing together. Thanks for listening.